Tonight on Arena, Sean Hewitt on Tom Poland's Namanla, Mike McCormack and Maggie Armstrong bring us an alternative Irish Christmas, and Colin Davidson on Stranger. You are, as always, very welcome along to Wednesday night's Arena. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena@rte.ie, and we're on Instagram at @RTE_arena, and that'll prove to be a little bit useful later on in tonight's programme. An Alternative Irish Christmas is a new short story collection from publishers Lisa Cohen and Sarah Davis Goff of Tramp Press. As the title indicates, these tales may or may not live up to the hype of the perfect festive season. Short stories range from Jessica Traynor's Careless People to Sophie White's We Need to Talk About Christmas via that famous scene from The Green Road by Anne Enright, the high-pressure ritual of shopping for Christmas dinner. Maggie Armstrong is with me now in studio, and Mike McCormack is on the line. You're both very welcome to tonight's Arena. Maggie, when Lisa and Sarah came to you to commission a new Christmas short story, what was the brief they gave you, if any?
So the brief, Rick, was that Christmas is a multiplicity of experiences for a multitude of people, and it was going to be very hard to pin down what Christmas is. So they left it completely open, and it was a high summer when it was commissioned. So these stories, we all sat down and did our best and with burning sunshine outside to write about bleak midwinter and Irish traditions.
Is that easier or harder being given a commission like that, that is so broad sometimes where you're not given guardrails?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I've always longed to write a Christmas story. And so it was very exciting for me because I probably write one every year that I do nothing with. And this was really exciting. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to have really cold weather in it and a Christmas tree that was sort of dying. And then I shamelessly kind of wanted to write a romantic Christmas story, a highly sentimental romantic story. But I guess the hardest thing maybe was writing something that maybe has meaning and truth and, you know, makes some kind of a difference about a season that is quite obscenely commercial and materialistic.
Was that important? Because it's so easy to write about Christmas, but there are cliches left, right and centre, and they're kind of hard to avoid.
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Grafton Street, shopping on Grafton Street. I mean, loads of this story took place shopping on Grafton Street and in the Switzer's windows. And then I rewrote it and did it loads of times. And yeah, I mean, there's a reason that James Joyce quit writing short stories in his youth.
Mike, what comes to mind for you when you think about Christmas stories, and what came to mind then when Tramp Press asked you to write something for this?
Yeah, I guess what comes to mind immediately when you think about Christmas are all the warm human values of people gathering together in love and harmony, the giving and the receiving of presents, and the child savior coming to illumine the world in the deep midwinter. And an alternative to that is, well, you sweep those things aside or you turn your back on them and see, is there some other thing that you can put in its place? And the commission came in the middle of summer, and I think I'm at my stage of writing where I'm kind of, I'm glad that someone comes to me and say, will you write about this? Because generating ideas becomes more and more difficult sometimes than that. You're glad not to be listening to yourself. You're glad to listen to someone else's idea for a change. So when the idea came in June or July or something like that, yeah, I said, absolutely, I'll go for it and see what sort of a fist I can make out of it.
And did you have anything that you either particularly wanted to make sure you included in it or things that you absolutely had to avoid?
I just sit down and I think, okay, Christmas, what happens? We get visitors at Christmas. And that's pretty much the beginning of the story. It's the classic opening of a knock comes to a door and open the door and who's on the doorstep. And so it get that's about as, in some sense, it's about as formulaic an opening as you can have. But it's what you do with it after that, and where you take the story after that. And you do it within under the kind of narrative rubric of Christmas. And so, yeah, I started it and wrote a piece called Adeste Fideles, of Come All Ye Faithful.
I want to ask both of you about the difference between writing novels and writing short stories, because both of you have written for Tramp Press in the other capacity as well. Maggie, your debut novel, Old Romantics, published by Tramp Press, shortlisted for Newcomer of the Year at the Irish Book Awards. What's the difference for you between writing a short story and writing a novel in your own head?
Oh, the tremendous effort of economy. You have so little space to say sometimes a very big idea, and yeah, it's you really want to make a spell. I think that's what a story, you want a story to cast a sort of a spell, and you have very little space to do that. But I do think it could be one of the greatest pleasures is to read something that's short.
And what about for you, Mike, that idea of the difference between approaching something like Solar Bones or This Plague of Souls or short stories? Because you've written short story collections like Getting It in the Head, so you've done both.
Yeah, I have. And I think it's only in the last couple of years that it's come to me just how kind of, not from a readerly point of view, because I get the difference between sitting down and reading a 10-page short story, and the difference between sitting down and that and reading a 250-page novel. I get that difference, but the difference comes in the writing. I think for years and years, and until very recently, I confused the writing of a novel with just writing a very long short story. That's what it was. That at the beginning of the writing of a novel, I'd set myself in and set my horizons off in the distance, and I'd think of it as a short story. But it's a completely different ask, and it's one I can't explain. But what baffles me about it is that I've confused the whole thing. Is that I've confused the thing for 30 years. That I've proceeded writing novels in the same way as that, oh, they're just a long or short story. They're not. It's a completely different ask. It's neither easier nor better, or neither easier nor harder than that. It's just very, very different. It's just a completely different ask. And it's not just a longer piece of writing. It's just thematically, technically, existentially a completely different ask. And I'm surprised that, well, I'm not really. I'm a slow learner, that it has only taken me 30 years to realise that. That's about par for the course.
It seems to have worked out okay in the end.
He's pulling it off.
I hope so.
Maggie, your story for this anthology is Little Christmas. It features Bridget and Jack. They're on a night out. So who are they? Where did this start as an idea? And then maybe you'd read a little piece of it for us.
Okay. Well, I don't really know who they are, but they occurred to me as two Dubliners who are just on the end of the season, and they have met. It's very cold. I wanted to put two people in a scenario on a very cold night to see what would happen, because I mean, like, it would be awful to go home on your own, wouldn't it, in a freezing night? So they're on a date, basically. They are kind of middle-aged, so we don't really, I didn't know what was going to happen, you know, from when they arrive home. And yeah, she's very deeply cynical. And yeah, so I mean, Little Christmas, in my childhood, it was very exciting, you know, the innocence. It was when my parents were Catholic, religious, we had a crib, and it was when my sisters and I got to put the three wise kings in the crib. I mean, I find that touching just to think about it. But we didn't have the tradition of Nullig na Mlan, where it's being kind of revived now, where a woman puts her feet up while the men around her clean up. It was more just that was the feast of the Epiphany, the 6th of January was when we put the wise kings in the crib, and that was enough for us, excitement wise. So it takes place around then. Do you want me to?
Yeah, maybe you read something for us now,
okay.
Please.
Dear Lord, I'll give it a whirl. Okay. It was nearly midnight when they got off the tram, hidden deep in woolen overcoats. Bridget sped up the path and Jacques followed. Where? He wasn't sure. Neither of them knew where this thing they had begun was going to end, but the cold was stupendous. -3 with a frozen Grand Canal and east winds that just felt cruel. Was he walking her home for her safety or for his advantage? Recently, she'd begun to realise that every man she'd ever known had been a fraud. Worse, their common element was her, and she had orchestrated every problem. They were back on the subject of the film as they crossed under the tram bridge onto her deserted street. Bitter January wind blanched their faces and she gripped herself, crumpling closed her gloved fingers. Emma Stone was all right, but I don't think a French harlot would take that much pleasure from her work, she said. He slowed his step and looked at her to elaborate, but just then an icy blast whisked her coat around her body and lifted up her hair, spraying it around her head in a wild halo and sticking strands to her lipstick. She pressed it back behind her ears, embarrassed. Earlier, she'd been so contained, she reckoned she'd fooled everyone.
That's Maggie Armstrong reading from an alternative Irish Christmas, her story, Little Christmas. Mike, yours has the very festive title of Adeste Fideles, so why that name?
Well, it's about a stranger who shows up at a door and her name is Faith. And she comes knocking on a door at a time which is Christmas calendar. It's that time of year, it's Christmas time of year, but she comes as the only one in the world who seems to believe in Christmas anymore. We're now in a world where Christmas has been eclipsed, has fallen into oblivion. And she comes as a woman called, her name is Faith, and she comes to this household to say thank you to the parents and to the of a person who has donated something to her. And will I read the first page?
Please do.
Okay. Adeste Fideles. She did not look as if she was used to knocking on strange doors at any time of the day, much less so late in the year. My own anger on seeing her standing there couldn't have helped. No, I barked, no more interviews. I've had enough. And how she stepped back and raised both hands in a bid for patience stopped me from slamming the door in her face. I'm not here for an interview, she said. I'm just here to say thanks. I stalled, closing the door in mid-swing. She dropped her hands to step forward. I just wanted to say thanks. I'm one of those who, I know who you are. That's all I could manage as we stood facing each other. For some reason, I believe she had come a long way. The stiff way she carried herself suggested she had put miles behind her. And though she looked tired, it was something other than fatigue that had put those lines through her face. Martha shouldered away into the door beside me. Same angry impatience rolling off her in waves. No, she said bluntly, no more interviews. Haven't you people had enough? I raised a hand. It's okay, Martha, I said. It's not an interview. A word of thanks, the woman added. I thought it was the least I could do. So that's the beginning of it. That's the first page of Adeste Fideles.
The narrator's wife, Martha, in this story in particular, she's very angry. There's been a cost to their daughter, Ellen, for donating this enzyme. That's kind of the critical part of the story, isn't it?
Yeah, Ellen was one of a few, very few women who carries this enzyme. It's an enzyme that has been nurtured in these people, and it goes back to pre-famine times. And her child, Ellen, has donated this enzyme, and it seems to carry with it a cure for depression and for psychiatric illnesses. And this woman has turned up at the door to thank her for it. But Ellen has suffered because of giving this, and her mother Martha here is enraged that this is what has happened to her daughter. And it's about a marriage being stressed. It's about a woman saying thanks, and it's about a young woman who has done the right thing by her gift, but has paid a heavy price for it.
We asked both of you to choose something else as well, aside from your own stories. Maggie, we asked you to choose a second one. Which one stood out for you?
So all of the stories I've read here have been tremendous, and there is a multiplicity. Like, just in this one anthology, you've got grieving parents, you've got a deathbed, you've got an orgy, you've got a mother and daughter who despise each other and storm out on each other. One story just really gladdened me so much, and that was Swans by Tim McGowan, who's a wonderful writer from Kilkenny, and he has written multiple books. His most recent is The Black Pool, which is, you've read it, seems.
It's great.
Yeah, it's his a memoir of addiction and recovery. It's a grueling, very beautiful and very, very comic read. And all of those elements were here in this story, Swans. And I guess what was so pleasing about it was he's playing from the first paragraph. He tells us, you know, in the opening lines, there's characters arriving in a house, and he says that Leilani, who's serving drinks at a party, she's checking the drinks levels, and she'd be literally run off her feet. And that, for any like truffle hunting Joyce fans out there, will know that, you know, that's the opening paragraph of The Dead as well, or the opening line, where Lily, the caretaker's daughter, was literally run off her feet as she's opening the door to guests. And sure enough, it's a party with friends, which, you know, I think many of us do at this time of year, you know, a reunion of friends, Christmas sort of gathering. And the difference, you know, it's not the Mrs. Morgan's annual dance, you know, that's not the petty bourgeois Dubliners of Joyce's time, but it's contemporary Dubliners who have, they are kind of disaffected, they're worried about climate, they're worried about the state of the world. They are, one of the protagonists is just sucking on a hash vape for the whole evening, and they're very interested in polygamy, or just talking about it. And then there's a Deliveroo, there's a cheesecake Deliveroo, and it just is really, really beautiful. Swans, it turns out, are not as monogamous creatures as we thought they were.
And that's Tim McGowan's story from the collection. Mike, we asked you to do the same thing. Who did you choose?
Yeah, as Maggie has said there, this is a treasure trove, and it is a treasure trove of fiction in that, but there's actually one essay in it. Roisin Kiber's Give Up Your Inquiries, which are completely useless. And I'm a huge admirer of Roisin's work. She's one of the most able and lucid and penetrating intelligence using the essay form at the moment. Our collection of essays in 2021, The Disconnect, was this brilliant book about life with the internet and life on the internet. But in this piece, she sets herself the task, I would have thought a really difficult task, of trying to rehabilitate the Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick's last movie. And Stanley, this is the movie with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman that the whole world went to see. It was billed as an erotic thriller, and the whole world went to see it because there was going to be great talk, that there was going to be, you know, love scenes, and we were going to see an erotic kind of a feast and everything like that. And I remember watching the movie at the time, and it was a dry, abstract, chilly affair, and I could not get my head around it. But Roisin's essay, she brings all her lucid intelligence and her lyricism towards it, and a bit of a side eye on her own kind of anxieties, her own kind of relationship anxieties, and that. And she makes this marvelous job of rehabilitating Kubrick's film as a kind of a Night Town Odyssey, in which a man journeys out and suffers. Tom Cruise journeys out into a New York night town. He suffers humiliations and defeats, and he returns home slightly bettered by his adventures. It's a brilliant essay. She writes really lucidly. There isn't a sentence or a paragraph you have to reread in order to get the thread of her argument. And she writes really incredibly convincingly about a movie that I did not think could be reclaimed or could be redeemed. But the worth of this essay is that I'm going to go and watch the movie again.
It has been wonderful to talk to both of you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us on Arena. Maggie Armstrong and Mike McCormack. An Alternative Irish Christmas is published by Tramp Press. On Monday evening, at a ceremony at the National Library in Dublin, the second recipient of the Pen Heaney Award was announced. Named after Seamus Heaney, it rewards a poet for their outstanding literary merit, but also engages with the impact of cultural and political events on human conditions or relationships. This year, the judges gave the prize to the Northern Irish poet Tom Paulin. It's Tom's first collection in a decade. After dealing with depression, he returns to Ireland in this collection of poems, from writing about politics to the pleasures of cooking and to a County Donegal loch called Namanlagh, which gives the collection its title. I'm delighted to say that one of the judges of this year's Pen Heaney Award, poet, memoirist and novelist Sean Hewitt, joins me now. Sean, you're very welcome. Welcome to Arena. Poetry must be a difficult medium to judge in the context of literary awards like this. How hard is that as a task?
It's very hard. We had about 80 books to read through, myself, Sasha Dugdale and Zafa Kneel, who were the other judges. And, you know, in some ways it's comparing apples and oranges. And we came up with a shortlist that we thought was a pretty heavyweight shortlist. But they were all such different books. We had books that used photography, prose poems, books that were more traditional lyric books. And of course, one of them was Tom Paulin's Namanlagh, which I just think is one of the most brilliant collections I've read in years.
Yeah, how do you square that circle when you're dealing with collections that are, as you say, apples and oranges, radically different from each other, and that you can't exactly have any objective criteria for them, can you?
No, of course not. I mean, between the three of us, we read these six books on the shortlist many times over the past couple of months, and the thing that I think clinched it for Tom Paulin's book was that the more we read it, the more it seemed to grow underneath our eyes. It seemed to begin teeming with all these secrets and intricacies that seemed to reward repeated rereading. It was a book that I felt, as I was reading it, I wanted to take photographs of the poems and send them to people and say, you have to read this one. And it gave me the sense that over years to come, this is a book that will stand up and stand the test of time.
Just to give people a sense of the collection, perhaps you'd read the title poem of it, Namanlagh.
Of course, yeah. I'm very glad we were all three of us debating how to pronounce Namanlagh. So here we have it. Somewhere in the pine trees beyond the loch, two stones are being knocked together. Once, twice, three times, very dry. Maybe it's a chain gang working in the quarry. There is no quarry, though, and there never was a chain gang. Only the little chunks of red granite on the long, looping bog road tell of famine relief, congested districts, that human weather that sticks like salt stains or burrs in your hair. No, I realize all these are not, in fact, the case. It's a stone chat I can hear. It's clattery cry that's like the real hard stuff. Potsheen distilled on stony hills where the black creature, the chough, should be sounding its red beak, its curved bill against the screes, not hiding out on the soft bog by the lock.
What was it about that poem that made it stand out for you in the collection?
To me, I mean, it kind of gets to the heart of, this is a collection that is full of the Irish landscape and full of the history of Ireland. And one of the key things that we were looking for was poetry that seems profoundly affected by and speaking back to political and cultural events. And in this one collection and in that poem, we open up and the poem just turns right down into this phrase, which I love, which is the real hard stuff. And this is a book that, you know, you could characterize as spare. Some of the poems are single stanzas, and there's not huge linguistic fireworks at play here. It's quite toned down, or honed down is a better word, down to these, like, hard, resistant facts of life, and that bird, which appears again at the end of the book, offers a sort of circularity and a completion to the book. It's a lovely thing. I mean, it's, as you said in your intro, 10 years in the making, and so many of these poems are about not being able to write poems. And there is this oddly dark subject matter. I mean, depression is shot right through the heart of this book. And a lot of that seems to stem from this inability to articulate things. And as you read it, you're kind of willing Tom Paulin on, because you can see before you that he's writing the poem. And you're saying, go on, Tom, you're getting there. And the poems just lift off. And there are these moments of birdsong or light breaking or of sudden a sense of having overcome something that makes this, I think, a really life-affirming book. For all its bleakness of subject matter, I think it's a book about resistance and overcoming.
In the context of the Penn Heaney Award, Sean, do you think it's important? It's an award that is given out for superlative writing, but it's also for a poet who engages with the world culturally and politically. Do you think that's important?
I think it is. I mean, you know, there are those people that will say that it's almost impossible to write a good political poem, as if politics and poetry kind of stand in opposition to each other, or that politics might make a poem crumble. But I think Tom Paulin here just shows how untrue that is. I mean, here there are poems on the macro scale and on the micro scale that just encompass so much. There are translations here from Ronsard, from Brecht, from a contemporary Palestinian poet called Waleed Khazandar. And all the time you can see the poems engaging, reforming aspects of the world and using what poetry does best, which is to complicate matters as a way of speaking back to politics. I mean, there's a poem in here that's one of my favorites called Decommissioning. And it begins with an epigraph that is that made me laugh. I think the epigraph is the IRA are playing hardball. And the first line of the poem is as if they'd be playing softball. But what I noticed in there when I was rereading today is that the word gun is rhymed or half rhymed with the word gone in this poem about decommissioning. And there are these small acts of resistance that I think can rewrite or stand as testimony to entire big complex histories. And I think that's what poetry does best.
The connection in here with, as you mentioned, Waleed Khazandar, the Palestinian poet, is an interesting one. There's a succession of poems written after him. Was that a particular engagement that made you think that this was an important collection?
Yeah, I mean, I think, if I remember rightly, in Tom Paulin's previous collection, Love's Bonfire, I think there were translations of Waleed Khazandar in that book as well. The thing that really stood out to us was the breadth of this book. I mean, it's a very short book. I think it's about 50, 55 pages. But through it, there is translations, there are these poems that even those Waleed Khazandar poems, they don't give their politics up easily. But the fact of them in here, the fact that they're kind of sitting alongside Tom Paulin's voice being reflected on in the book, seems to speak something to Tom's generosity. And I think that at the ceremony on Monday night, it was, you know, Tom's generosity and grace really was on display. He almost, when he did his speech, just thanked Seamus Heaney and said how wonderful it was to have a prize named in Heaney's honor. And I think all of that generosity towards poetry and towards this wider global community of poets is really important for him and for us as we were reading.
Where do you think that Tom Paulin fits into that canon of extraordinary poets who've come out of Northern Ireland? People like Ciarán Carson and Maeve McGuckian and Heaney and Michael Longley and Paul Muldoon, who we're speaking to on Monday night's Arena here, and who chose this collection before the judges announced the award as one of his favourite books of the year.
Oh, he's got good taste. I think, you know, it's such an extraordinary constellation of poets there. And in Namanla, you can feel them kind of gathering around Tompul. And then in some ways, it's a reflective book. There's subtle little nods to other poets. I think Derek Mahon appears, he's not named, but there's a famous poet or a poet who made a shed famous, I think is the line. So you can see this kind of gesturing outwards to this great generation. But I think Tom is perhaps one of our remaining public poets. He's someone who commands a great deal of respect amongst poets and also the general public. And we were so grateful, really, to be able to honor this book. It was at the end of our judging meeting, I walked out feeling almost like I'd won a prize. To be able to give a prize to Tom Paulden was a great honor.
I'm interested, he's 76 now, and even though in this collection he despairs of writing another poem because of his depression, he still produces this incredible collection. Do poets age better than other artists?
I mean, it's a difficult one. I think I heard Paul Muldoon on Monday talking about this very thing with, Wordsworth being the key example of a poet who gets worse and worse. but I think that the best poet manages to keep the poetry living as they age, and they don't just reproduce the same poem and in that way kind of fall outside of time. They reform in the same way perhaps that musicians and great musicians can do. I'm thinking of Leonard Cohen or someone like that, or Madonna for that matter. But here I think you can see Tom Paulin changing, and the way he writes and what he writes is reflecting something new in this later stage of life that he hasn't experienced before, and he's grappling with and giving voice to. This is a great collection about aging. It's a great collection about the sort of peace and also sometimes loneliness of that. It's, I think, a book that you could very happily give to so many different sorts of people, and they would find something to treasure in it.
I wonder, just before we finish, would you mind reading one more poem from the collection for us?
Yeah, of course. I might read the last poem because Tom read it on Monday, and I think it does a lot. It's called Folly Bridge, and that title is important because he's thinking about poetry and its follies, I think, but also its power. Strange houses by the River Thames, where just now I'm walking about 8 p.m. this mild October evening, end of National Poetry Day, when words take off, and looking at the light in a window, a tiny, uncurtained, high-up window in the eccentric Gothic house by Folly Bridge, with those white busts and statues, ghostly figures, set into its darkling walls, strange crenellated brick by castly walls. Looking at that tiny light, I think of Milton, one starlit night, staring at the plough and the bear from his high, lonely tower, a tower that passed from him to Shelley, then Yeats, who, though sometimes silly, made a gift of it to Philip Larkin, who looked up at the moon stark in the night sky and saw from his high window the keen, silvery, slivery glow of a single air-sharpened blade, which, when all is done and said, is Yeats's luminous lunar words turned by another pen into a sword, the sword of art, of poetry, but bright and peaceful, like the shiny moon or this window above a bridge called Folly.
Sean Hewitt, it has been wonderful to talk to you tonight on Arena. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Namanla by Tom Paulin is published by Faber. Stranger is a new exhibition by Belfast-born artist Colin Davidson. Best known for his grand-scale portraits, sitters have included Queen Elizabeth II, Seamus Heaney and Bono, but his latest works combine both paint and sculpture with remarkable effect. A group of six monumental figures named after Irish landmarks such as Tara, Comeda and Lugnaquilla have been painstakingly crafted from thickened oil paint. 5 years of research and experimentation have culminated in this innovative collection, which is currently being exhibited at the RHA Gallery in Dublin. And Colin Davidson joins us on the line from Bangor in County Down this evening. You'll find some images from the exhibition on the RTE Arena Instagram if you'd like to look as well as listen. Colin, welcome to Arena. For more than 15 years, you've been associated with portrait painting, but you call this new work Paintings You Can Walk Around. So does Stranger represent a change of direction for you?
Hi, Rick. I think it's a development rather than a change of direction. I think as an artist, you're always looking for those whims, those things that catch you off guard from left field. And I'd always been aware, I think, in my practice, really from the start, about the tactile, viscous, almost sculptural quality that oil paint has. I mean, we look back to Rembrandt, and I mean, we can see that tactile quality in his paintings. I simply wondered, and this was about 5-6 years ago, I simply wondered what it would be like to, instead of sculpting with clay or wax or carving in stone, what it might be like to use oil paint to actually sculpt with. And that's where it came from. It was a natural development from my practice, I suppose. And I love the idea of taking painting into three dimensions, not just making a sculpture and putting a surface decoration onto it, but actually using the physical quality of paint to work with in three dimensions.
Because I realise not everybody will have access to Instagram to look at the images tonight. They look, to all intents and purposes, as if you have sculpted figures out of oil paint. But obviously that's not what you've done here. So could you explain the actual artistic process that's involved in physically making these works?
Sure. And I had a vision in my mind as to what I wanted to achieve. And I've spent the last 5 years bringing that to fruition. I joke about this, there isn't a YouTube tutorial as to how to make these things, because I would have loved to have been able to access it. Essentially, my vision was that there would be a room where there were these presences that were made from paint that were bigger than us. And quickly realised that if I was going to sculpt with paint, that actually, no matter how thick the paint, gravity takes hold at a certain point and simply pulls the paint down. So I realised that in order to really have and to capture the nuance of all those swirls and flicks and blobs, I needed to make the images quite small to start off with. So I started off with a little maquette. I'm actually looking at them in my studio now. They're about 15 centimetres high. And I made a little wire skeleton. And I then built it out with wax. And then piled the oil paint onto it and used the oil paint to sculpt with. Now, what I then did was used the technology of photogrammetry, which is like a 3D scanning way of working. And so 3D scanned them in high res, enlarged it on the computer, and then 3D printed that again and glued it all together. And then attacked that thing with paint again, using it as a blank canvas with, I suppose, cues and clues as to where the paint was before in the smaller version. So what we are seeing is huge, well, huge as in, you know, a 20, 30 centimeter flick of paint that normally wouldn't sit because gravity would pull it down, actually having a presence, actually having a role in dictating what these sculptures are, what these paintings are, whatever way you choose to describe them. And yeah, so I love putting myself in challenging positions. I love, as an artist, I realize that nothing creatively exciting happens when I'm in my comfort zone. So I've been very firmly out of my comfort zone in making these works.
I'm interested. It feels like there's quite a delicate balance between what's familiar about these figures, but also what's unfamiliar as well. So the figures are recognisable in that they are human-like and they have flesh-coloured tones, but the features are indistinct and they're blurred by what looks like the action of brush strokes. So what do you imagine or what do you hope will happen when visitors encounter them?
I hope they will do what you've just done, and that is to interpret these for themselves. My art, and I've been really quite careful about this throughout my career. It's important that art doesn't preach or tell us what to think. Art is there as a vehicle through which we can explore as viewers. The work which the paintings, the sculpture, the music, the poetry that I love is those works of art where there is room for me to find myself in, room for me to fill those gaps, room for me to complete the works. And I think I know that I made them as a response to what I was doing in the studio, my studio practice. I knew that I had been painting, I suppose, people who were conventionally well known and very specific people over a period of 16 years. And what I wanted to do is turn that on its head and go, right, I don't want any references. I mean, I think we can just about make out in this exhibition, there is a male-female thing that you can just about make out, but there's still an ambiguity about that. And I love an ambiguity that allows us to decode and to explore and to perhaps enlighten as a result of that. So I'm not evading your question. I'm just simply saying that's the role which you as the viewer has.
Now that you mentioned taking your work out of the studio, I understand a key part of your practice as an artist is to take to a hilltop over Belfast or a rooftop once a year to reconnect with the city through your work as an artist. Does Belfast continue to inspire you?
Yeah, it does. I've painted Belfast since childhood. I've painted what I grew up in. And I suppose what I do, I did an exhibition in Belfast about, you know, sort of 22, 23 years ago. And it was looking at the city, I suppose, post Good Friday Agreement, post ceasefires, and see how it had changed. And I realized, I realized as I went along that I was making portraits of this place, that there was I was seeing my home city as a living, breathing entity. And Belfast is remarkable in the sense that you can get up on really high viewpoints. I mean, Black Mountain just perched to the west affords quite remarkable views. And I've ended up returning once a year to making these paintings of the views from rooftops or the hills, and they're an extension of Irish landscape, I suppose. But instead of fluffy clouds and cottages and turf bogs, this is a living, breathing entity of a city with all the jumbled dualities that are going on. But I find that no matter what I'm doing throughout the year, and this certainly was the case with the three-dimensional work that we're talking about, I see it as a benchmark. I see it as a grounding to come back to the familiar and to kind of take stock of the year and to, I'm in the middle of one now. I'm actually quite coincidentally making 2025's Belfast painting now. And, you know, it's remarkable how the handling and the observation to me has shifted because I've been working in three dimensions all year. So that's why I do it. It's a personal thing. It's for me. But they end up finding homes, I suppose.
Just maybe briefly before we finished, you've talked about how important you think it is to continue to push beyond your comfort zone as an artist. You're certainly doing that in your current collection. Is that vital to you in terms of in the future?
Yes, it is. I view life as a gift, and I don't mean that in a religious sense. I mean it in a sense that, you know, it is an immense privilege to be on this planet. I know not everybody can say that, but I choose to. And I kind of owe that gift, whether it's from the universe or wherever it's from, I owe that gift back. And I need to wring every last bit of potential out of that gift. And I see it as a responsibility that I've got. And, you know, there is no point in me just churning out the same old stuff. Firstly, I would bore myself. I wouldn't want to come into the studio. But also, you end up boring everybody else as well. And I concern myself less and less as I age with what people think of my work. I kind of now realise that there needs to be an honesty to it from my point of view. I think I always realised that, but I've shed the what people think aspect. And yeah, this Stranger exhibition exemplifies where I'm at now, where, you know, these are challenging pieces. They're possibly challenging to observe and to be in, although a lot of people find them benign and comforting as well. And I was talking to somebody today who'd been in the exhibition, and they were saying that they found it strangely emotional being in the room. So that's what makes it worthwhile. And I just need to constantly be challenging myself. That's my life.
Well, I think for those people who have looked at the pictures on our Instagram, they don't really do them justice, and you do have to be in the room in order to witness the pieces in this. Colin Davidson, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this evening.
Thanks very much.
Stranger is the title of Colin's new exhibition. It's currently taking place at the RHA Gallery in Dublin, and it'll continue until the 25th of January next year. 12 Paintings, Colin Davidson in Conversation with Mark Carruthers is the title of the recently published book, which explores his life and work as an artist through 12 of his key works. The book's structured around a series of deeply personal conversations with the broadcaster Mark Carruthers, and the foreword is by none other than actor Simon Callow. 12 Paintings is published by Merrion Press. That is it for Arena for tonight. Produced by Reg Luby. Paula Shields is our researcher. Broadcast coordinator is Ollie Hamilton, and Kieran Cullen is on sound. Tomorrow night it's movie reviews. We'll be talking to Irish director David Frayne about his new film Eternity, and Joseph O'Connor on the literary connections between Italy and Ireland. We'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7. John Creedon is next.